The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hey everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I'll read a short story by Kazuo Ishiguro, the 2017 winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature. And this will be followed by an article on the Antifa movement in Portland, Oregon. And now, from the fiction section of the May 21st, 2001 edition of the New Yorker magazine, A Village After Dark, by Kazuo Ishiguro. There was a time when I could travel England for weeks on end and remained at my sharpest, when, if anything, the traveling gave me an edge. But now that I'm older, I become disoriented more easily. So it was on arriving at the village just after dark, I failed to find my bearings at all. I could hardly believe I was in the same village in which, not so long ago, I had lived and come to exercise such influence. There was nothing I recognized, and I found myself walking forever around twisting, badly lit streets, hemmed in on both sides by the little stone cottages characteristic of the area. The streets often became so narrow I could make no progress without my bag or my elbow scraping one rough wall or another. I persevered nonetheless, stumbling around in the darkness in the hope of coming upon the village square, where I could at least orient myself, or else of encountering one of the villagers. When after a while I had done neither, a weariness came over me, and I decided my best course was to just choose a cottage at random, knock on the door, and hope it would be opened by someone who remembered me. I stopped by a particularly rickety-looking door, whose upper beam was so low that I could see I would have to crouch right down to enter. A dim light was leaking out under the door's edges, and I could hear voices and laughter. I knocked loudly to ensure that the occupants would hear me over their talk. But just then someone behind me said, "Hello!" I turned to find a young woman of around 20, dressed in raggedy jeans and a torn jumper, standing in the darkness a little way away. "You walked straight past me earlier," she said, "even though I called to you." "Did I really? Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be rude. You're Fletcher, aren't you?" "Yes," I said, somewhat flattered. "Wendy thought it was you when you went by our cottage. We all got very excited. You were one of that lot, weren't you? With David Magus and all of them?" "Yes," I said, "but Magus was hardly the most important one. I'm surprised you pick him out like that. There were other far more important figures." And I reeled off a series of names and was interested to see the girl nodding at each one in recognition. "But this must have been all before your time," I said. "I'm surprised you know about such things." "Well, it was before our time, but we're experts on your lot. We know more about all that than most of the older ones who were here then. Wendy recognized you instantly just from your photos." "Well, I had no idea you young people had taken such an interest in us. I'm sorry I walked past you earlier, but you see, now that I'm older, I get a little disoriented when I travel." I could hear some boisterous talk coming from behind the door. I banged on it again, this time rather impatiently, though I was not so eager to bring the encounter with the girl to a close. She looked at me for a moment and then said, "All of you from those days are like that. David Magus came here a few years ago, in 93 or maybe it was 94. He was like that, a bit vague. It must get to you after a while, traveling all the time." "Huh, so Magus was here. How interesting. You know, he wasn't one of the really important figures. You mustn't get carried away with such an idea. Incidentally, perhaps you could tell me who lives in this cottage." I thumped the door again. "The Petersons," the girl said. "They're an old house. They They'll probably remember you. The Petersons? I repeated, but the name meant nothing to me. Why don't you come to our cottage? Wendy was really excited. So were the rest of us. It's a real chance for us, all actually talking to someone from those days. Oh, I'd very much like to do that, but first of all, I better get myself settled in. The Petersons, you say? I thumped the door again, this time quite ferociously. At last it opened, throwing warmth and light out into the street. An old man was standing in the doorway. He looked at me carefully and then asked, "It's not Fletcher, is it?" "Well, yes, I've just gotten into the village. I've been traveling for several days." He thought about this for a moment and then said, "Well, you'd better come in." I found myself in a cramped, untidy room full of rough wood and broken furniture. A log burning in the fireplace was the only source of light, by which I could make out a number of hunched figures sitting around the room. The old man led me to a chair beside the fire with a grudgingness that suggested it was the very one he had just vacated. Once I sat down, I found I could not easily turn my head to see my surroundings or the others in the room. But the warmth of the fire was very welcome, and for a moment I just stared into its flames, a pleasant grogginess drifting over me. Voices came from behind me, inquiring if I was very well, and if I'd come far, if I was hungry. And I replied as best I could, though I was aware that my answers were barely adequate. Eventually, the questions ceased. And it occurred to me that my presence was creating a heavy awkwardness. But I was so grateful for the warmth and the chance to rest that I hardly cared. Nonetheless, when the silence behind me had gone unbroken for several minutes, I resolved to address my host with a little more civility, and I turned in my chair. It was then, as I did so, that I was suddenly seized by an intense sense of recognition. I had chosen the cottage quite at random, but now I could see that it was none other than the very one in which I had spent my years in the village. My gaze moved immediately to the far corner, at this moment shrouded in darkness, to the spot that had been my corner, where once my mattress had been, and where I had spent many tranquil hours browsing through books or conversing with whoever happened to drift in. On summer days, the windows and often the door were left open to allow a refreshing breeze to blow right through. Those were the days when the cottage was surrounded by open fields, and there would come from outside the voices of my friends, lazing in the long grass, arguing over poetry or philosophy. These precious fragments of the past came back to me so powerfully that it was all I could do not to make straight for my old corner then and there. Someone was speaking to me again, perhaps asking another question, but I hardly listened. Rising, I peered through the shadows into my corner, and could now make out a narrow bed, covered by an old curtain, occupying more or less the exact space where my mattress had been. The bed looked extremely inviting, and I found myself cutting into something the old man was saying. Look, I said, I know this is a bit blunt, but you see, I've come such a long way today, and I really need to lie down, close my eyes, even if it's just for a few minutes. After that, I'm happy to talk all you like. I could see the figures around the room shifting uneasily. Then a voice said, rather sullenly, "Go ahead, have a nap, don't mind us." But I was already picking my way through the clutter toward my corner. The bed felt damp, and the springs creaked under my weight. But no sooner had I curled up with my back to the room than my many hours of traveling began to catch up with me. As I was drifting off, I heard the old man saying, "It's Fletcher, all right. God, he's aged." A woman's voice said, "Should we let him go to sleep like that? He might wake up in a few hours, and then we'll have to stay up with him."
Let him sleep for an hour or so," someone else said. "If he's still asleep after an hour, we'll wake him."
At this point, sheer exhaustion overtook me. It was not a continuous or comfortable sleep. I drifted between sleep and waking,
always conscious of voices behind me in the room. At some point, I was aware of a woman saying, "I don't know how I was ever under his spell. He looks like such a ragamuffin now." In my near-sleep state, I debated with myself whether these words applied to me or perhaps to David Magus. But before long, sleep engulfed me once more. When I awoke, the room appeared to have grown both darker and colder. Voices were continuing behind me in lowered tones, but I could make no sense of the conversation. I now felt embarrassed at having gone to sleep in the way I had, and for a few further moments remained motionless with my face to the wall. But something about me must have revealed that I was awake, for a woman's voice, breaking off from the general conversation, said, "Oh, look, look." Some whispers were exchanged, and then I heard the sound of someone coming toward my corner. I felt a hand placed gently on my shoulder and looked up to find a woman kneeling over me. I did not turn my body sufficiently to see the room, but I got the impression that it was lit by dying embers, and the woman's face was visible only in shadow. "Now, Fletcher," she said, "it's time we had a talk. I've waited a long time for you to come back. I've thought about you often." I strained to see her more clearly. She was somewhere in her 40s, and even in the gloom, I noticed a sleepy sadness in her eyes. But her face failed to stir in me even the faintest of memories. "I'm sorry," I said. I have no recollection of you. "But please forgive me if we met some time ago. I do get very disoriented these days." "Fletcher," she said, "when we used to know one another, I was young and beautiful. I idolized you, and everything you said seemed like an answer. Now here you are, back again. I've wanted to tell you for many years that you ruined my life." "You're being unfair." "All right, I was mistaken about a lot of things, but I never claimed to have any answers. All I said in those days was that it was our duty, all of us, to contribute to the debate. We knew so much more about the issues than the ordinary people here. If people like us procrastinated, claiming we didn't yet know enough, then who was there to act? But I never claimed I had the answers. No, you're being unfair." "Fletcher," she said, and her voice was oddly gentle, "you used to make love to me, more or less every time I wandered in here to your room. In this corner, we did all kinds of beautifully dirty things. It's odd to think how I could have once been so physically excited by you. And here you're just a foul-smelling bundle of rags now. But look at me. I'm still attractive. My face has got a bit lined. But when I walk in the village streets, I wear dresses I've made specially to show off my figure. A lot of men want me still. But you? No woman will look at you now. A bundle of stinking rags and flesh." "I don't remember you," I said, "and I've no time for sex these days. I have other things to worry about, more serious things." "Very well. I was mistaken about a lot in those days, but I've done more than most to try and make amends. You see, even now I'm traveling. I've never stopped. I've traveled and traveled, trying to undo what damage I may once have caused. That's more than can be said of some others from those days. I bet Magus, for instance, hasn't worked nearly as hard to try and put things right." The woman was stroking my hair. "Look at you. I used to do this, run my fingers through your hair. Look at this filthy mess. I'm sure you're contaminated with all sorts of parasites." But she continued to slowly run her fingers through the dirty knots. I failed to feel anything erotic from this, as perhaps she wished me to do. Rather, her caresses were felt maternal. Indeed, for a moment, it was as though I had finally reached some cocoon of protectiveness, and I began once more to feel sleepy. But suddenly she stopped and slapped me hard on the forehead. "Why don't you join the rest of us now? You've had your sleep. You've got a lot of explaining to do. And with that, she got up and left. For the first time, I turned my body sufficiently to survey the room. I saw the woman making her way past the clutter on the floor and then sitting down in a rocking chair by the fireplace. I could see three other figures hunched around the dying fire. One I recognized to be the old man who had opened the door. The two others, sitting together on what looked like a wooden trunk, seemed to be women of around the same age as the one who had spoken to me. The old man noticed that I had turned, and he indicated to the others that I was watching. The four of them proceeded to sit stiffly, not speaking. From the way they did this, it was clear that they had been discussing me thoroughly while I was asleep. In fact, as I watched them, I could more or less guess the whole shape of their conversation. I could see, for instance, that they had spent some time expressing concern for the young girl I had met outside and about the effect I might have on her peers. "They're all so impressionable," the old man would have said, "and I heard her inviting him to visit them." To which, no doubt, one of the women on the trunk would have said, "But he can't do that much harm now. In our time, we were all taken in because all his kind, they were young and glamorous. But these days, the odd one passing through from time to time, looking all decrepit and burned out like that. If anything, it goes to demystify all that talk about the old days. In any case, people like him have changed their position so much these days, they don't know themselves what they believe." The old man would have shaken his head. I saw the way that young girl was looking at him. "All right, he looks a pitiful mess over there just now, but once his ego's fed a little, once he has the flattery of the young people, sees how they want to hear his ideas, then there'll be no stopping him. It'll be just like before. He'll have them all working for his causes. Young girls like that, there's so little for them to believe in now. Even a stinking tramp like this could give them a purpose." Their conversation, all the time I slept, would have gone something very much like that. But now, as I observed them from my corner, they continued to sit in guilty silence, staring at the last of their fire. After a while, I rose to my feet. Absurdly, the four of them kept their gazes averted from me. I waited a few moments to see if any of them would say anything. Finally, I said, "All right, I was asleep earlier, but I've guessed what you were saying. Well, you'll be interested to know that I'm going to do the very thing you feared. I'm going this moment to the young people's cottage. I'm going to tell them what to do with all their energy, all their dreams, their urge to achieve something of lasting good in this world." "Look at you. What a pathetic bunch. Crouching in your cottage, afraid to do anything, afraid of me, of Magus, of anyone else from those times. Afraid to do anything in the world out there just because once we made a few mistakes. Well, those young people haven't yet sunk so low, despite all the lethargy you've been preaching at them down through the years. I'll talk to them. I'll undo in half an hour all your sorry efforts." "You see," the old man said to the others, "I knew it would be this way. We ought to stop him. But what can we do?" I crashed my way across the room, picked up my bag, went out into the night. The girl was still standing outside when I emerged. She seemed to be expecting me, and with a nod, began to lead the way. The night was drizzly and dark. We twisted and turned along the narrow paths that ran between the cottages. Some of the cottages we passed looked so decayed and crumbling that I felt I could destroy one of them simply by running at it with all my weight. The girl kept a few paces ahead, occasionally glancing back at me over her shoulder. Once she said, "Wendy's going to be so pleased. She was sure it was you when you went past earlier. By now, I should have guessed she was right, because I've been away this long, and she'll have brought the whole crowd together. They'll all be waiting."
"Did you give David Magus this sort of reception, too?"
"Oh, yes. We were really excited when he came."
"I'm sure he found that very gratifying. He always had an exaggerated sense of his own importance."
"Well, Wendy says Magus was one of the interesting ones, but that you were, well, important. She thinks you were really important."
I thought about this for a moment. You know, I said, I've changed my mind on very many things. If Wendy's expecting me to say all the things I used to say to all those years ago, well, she's going to be in it for a disappointment. The girl did not seem to hear this, but continued to lead me purposely through the clusters of cottages. After a while, I became aware of the footsteps following a dozen or so paces behind us. At first, I assumed this was just some villager out walking and refrained from turning around. But then the girl halted under a street lamp and looked behind us. I was thus obliged also to stop and turn. A middle-aged man in the dark overcoat was coming toward us. As he approached, he held out his hand and shook mine, though without smiling. "So," he said, "you're here." I then realized I knew the man. We had not seen each other since we were 10 years old. His name was Roger Button, and he had been in my class at the school I had attended for 2 years in Canada before my family returned to England. Roger Button and I had not been especially close, but because he had been a timid boy, and because he too was from England, he had, for a while, followed me about. I had neither seen nor heard from him since that time. Now, as I studied his appearance under the street lamp, I saw the years had not been kind to him. He was bald, his face was pocked and lined, and there was a weary sag to his whole posture. For all that, there was no mistaking my old classmate. "Roger," I said, "I'm just on my way to visit this young lady's friends. They've gathered together to receive me. Otherwise, I'd have come and looked you up straight away. As it was, I had it in my mind as the next thing to do, even before getting any sleep tonight. I was just thinking to myself, however late things finish at the young people's cottage, I'll go and knock on Roger's door afterward." "Don't worry," said Roger Button as we all started to walk again. "I know how busy you are, but we ought to talk. Chew over old times. When you last saw me, at school I mean, I suppose I was a rather feeble specimen. But, you know, that all changed when I got to 14, 15. I really toughened up, became quite a leader type. But you'd long since left Canada. I always wondered what would have happened if we'd come across each other at 15. Things would have been rather different between us, I assure you." As he said this, memories came flooding back. In those days, Roger Button had idolized me, and in return, I had bullied him incessantly. However, there had existed between us a curious understanding that my bullying him was all for his own good, that when, without warning, I suddenly punched him in the stomach on the playground, or when, passing him in the corridor, I impulsively wrenched his arm up his back until he started to cry, I was doing so in order to help him toughen up. Accordingly, the principal effect such attacks had on our relationship was to keep him in awe of me. This all came back to me as I listened to the weary-looking man walking beside me. "Of course," Roger Button went on, perhaps guessing my train of thought, "it might well be that if you hadn't treated me the way you did, I'd never have become what I did at 15. In any case, I've often wondered how it would have been if we'd met just a few years later. I was really something to be reckoned with by then." We were once again walking along the narrow, twisted passages between cottages. The girl was still leading the way, but she was now walking much faster. Often we would only just manage to catch a glimpse of her turning some corner ahead of us, and it struck me that we would have to keep alert if we were not to lose her. "Today, of course," Roger Button was saying, "I've let myself go a bit, but I have to say, old fellow, you seem to be in much worse shape. Compared with you, I'm an athlete. Not to put too fine a point on it, you're just a filthy old tramp now. Really, aren't you? But, you know, for a long time after you left, I continued to idolize you. Would Fletcher do this? What would Fletcher think if he saw me doing that?
Oh, yes. It was only when I got to 15 or so that I looked back on it all and saw through you. Then I was very angry, of course. Even now, I still think about it sometimes. I look back and think, well, he was just a thoroughly nasty so-and-so. He had a little more weight and muscle at that age than I did, a little more confidence, and he took full advantage. Yes, it's very clear. Looking back, what a nasty little person you were. Of course, I'm not implying you still are today. We all change. That much I'm willing to accept. Have you been living here long? I asked, wishing to change the subject. Oh, 7 years or so. Of course, they talk about you a lot around here. I sometimes tell them about our early association. But he won't remember me, I always tell them. Why would he remember a skinny little boy he used to bully and have at his beck and call? Anyway, the young people here, they talk about you more and more these days. Certainly, the ones who've never seen you tend to idealize you the most. I suppose you've come back to capitalize on all that. Still, I shouldn't blame you. You're entitled to try and salvage a little self-respect. We suddenly found ourselves facing an open field, and we both halted. Glancing back, I saw that we had walked our way out of the village. The last of the cottages were some distance behind us. Just as I had feared, we had lost the young woman. In fact, I realized we had not been following her for some time. At that moment, the moon emerged, and I saw we were standing at the edge of a vast grassy field, extending, I suppose, far beyond what I could see by the moon. Roger Button turned to me. His face in the moonlight seemed gentle, almost affectionate. Still, he said, it's time to forgive. You shouldn't keep worrying so much. As you see, certain things from the past will come back to you in the end. But then, we can't be held accountable for what we did when we were so very young. No doubt you're right, I said. And then I turned around and looked around in the darkness. But now I'm not sure where to go. You see, there were some young people waiting for me in their cottage, but now they'd have a warm fire ready for me and some hot tea and some home-baked cakes, perhaps even a good stew. And the moment I entered, ushered in by that young lady we were following just now, they'd all have burst into applause. There'd be smiling, adoring faces all around me. That's what's waiting for me somewhere. Except I'm not sure where I should go. Roger Button shrugged. Don't worry. You'll get there easily enough. Except, you know, that girl was being a little misleading if she implied you could walk to Wendy's cottage. It's much too far. You'd really need to catch a bus. Even then, it's quite a long journey. About 2 hours, I'd say. But don't worry. I'll show you where you can pick up your bus. With that, he began to walk toward the cottages. As I followed, I could sense that the hour had got very late, and my companion was anxious to get some sleep. We spent several minutes walking around the cottages again, and then he brought us out into the village square. In fact, it was so small and shabby it hardly merited to be called a square. It was little more than a patch of green beside a solitary street lamp. Just visible beyond the pool of light cast by the lamp were a few shops, all shut up for the night. There was complete silence, and nothing was stirring. A light mist was hovering over the ground. Roger Button stopped before we had reached the green and pointed. There, he said. If you stand there, a bus will come along. As I say, it's not a short journey, about 2 hours. But don't worry, I'm sure your young people will wait. They've so little else to believe in these days, you see. It's very late, I said. Are you sure a bus will come? Oh, yes, of course, you may have to wait, but eventually a bus will come. Then he touched me reassuringly on the shoulder. I can see it might get a little lonely standing out here, but once the bus arrives, your spirits will rise, believe me. Oh, yes, that bus is always a joy. It'll be brightly lit up, and it's always full of cheerful people laughing and joking and pointing out the window. Once you board it, you'll feel warm and comfortable, and the other passengers will chat with you, perhaps offer you things to eat or drink.
There may even be singing. That depends on the driver. Some drivers encourage it, others don't. Well, Fletcher, it was good to see you. We shook hands, and then he turned and walked away. And I watched him disappear into the darkness between two cottages. I walked up to the green and put my bag down at the foot of the lamppost. I listened for the sound of a vehicle in the distance, but the night was utterly still. Nevertheless, I had been cheered by Roger Button's description of the bus. Moreover, I thought of the reception awaiting me at my journey's end, of the adoring faces of the young people, and felt the stirrings of optimism somewhere deep within me. And now, from the November 2nd, 2020 issue of the New Yorker magazine, letter from Portland section, In the Streets with Antifa, Trump is vowing to designate the movement as a terrorist organization, but its supporters believe that they are protecting their communities and that confronting fascists with violence can be justified. By Luke Molson. Shortly after noon, on September 26th, about 1,500 anti-fascists gathered on the lawn of Peninsula Park in Portland, Oregon. Some wore black block, the monochromatic clothing that renders militant activists anonymous to law enforcement. But the event was family-friendly, and most attendees had dressed accordingly. Booths set up in a leafy grove offered herbal teas and tinctures, arts and crafts, condoms and morning after pills, radical magazines, organic vegetables. Above a stage, a banner read, Everyday anti-fascist, come for the anarchy, stay for the soup. In July, President Donald Trump had claimed without evidence that anarchists were throwing soup cans at police during demonstrations for racial justice. When the anarchists were arrested, he explained, They say, no, this is soup for my family. Inevitably, soup for my family became a tongue-in-cheek slogan at Portland protests. Other presidential statements have been harder to make light of. Throughout the nationwide upheaval set in motion by the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis on May 25th, Trump has vilified demonstrators as nefarious insurrectionists. Much as adversaries of the civil rights movement once contended that it had been infiltrated by communists, he invokes anti-fascists or Antifa to delegitimize Black Lives Matter. A week after Floyd's death, as popular uprising spread from Minneapolis to other cities, the president declared, Our nation has been gripped by professional anarchists, violent mobs, arsonists, looters, criminals, rioters, Antifa, and others. As the election nears, he has portrayed Antifa as a grave security threat that the Democrats and their presidential nominee, Joe Biden, will let destroy the country. During the first debate, after Biden noted that Trump's FBI director, Chris Wray, had described Antifa as, quote, more of an ideology or a movement than an organization, end quote, Trump scoffed, You gotta be kidding me. And he told Biden, they'll overthrow you in 2 seconds. Such dire warnings are wildly disconnected from reality. Most Americans who identify as anti-fascist don't belong to any particular group, and there is no national Antifa hierarchy or leadership. To date, one American has been killed by someone professing an anti-fascist agenda. Right-wing extremists, by comparison, have been responsible for more than 320 deaths in the past quarter century. The only known plot to overthrow the government in recent months was hatched by right-wing militia members who, according to the FBI, planned to kidnap Michigan's Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer. In June, I stood next to the alleged ringleader, Adam Fox, during a rally at Michigan's Capitol, while a speaker yelled, We are here demanding peace as these terrorist organizations want to burn down our cities. Fox carried an assault rifle and wore an ammo vest with a patch that said, Si vis pacem, para bellum. If you want peace, prepare for war. It is true that, in response to such right-wing events, some leftists have mobilized under the name Antifa, following the tradition with specific principles, among them a willingness to engage in violence. The first speaker at Peninsula Park, a black activist and hip-hop artist named Mick Crenshaw, was one of the progenitors of this tradition. At 50 years old, he had had at least a couple of decades on most people in the crowd. Wearing sunglasses, a backward baseball cap, and a bulletproof vest over a plaid flannel shirt, Crenshaw said, "I used to tell people our motto was, 'We go where they go.'" And there's a lot of courageous people out there doing the same thing today. He patted his flak jacket. "I never thought 30 years ago I'd be standing up here with one of these things on." Crenshaw grew up in Minneapolis. One hub for young radicals in Minneapolis was Backroom Anarchist Books, which sold revolutionary European newspapers like Class War. From these periodicals, the Crenshaw learned about Anti-Fascist Action, a British organization dedicated to physically confronting racists and anti-Semites. Anti-Fascist Action had revived a legacy in England stretching back to the 30s, when Londoners prevented Oswald Mosley and his British Union of Fascists from publicly assembling. In 1987, Crenshaw and others established Anti-Racist Action, or ARA, and began recruiting skaters, college students, and black and Latino gang members. Explaining ARA's decision to tweak the British name, Crenshaw told me, "To us, the word fascist sounded too academic, but everybody knows what a racist is." In 2007, neo-Nazis attempting to reinvigorate the vestiges of war planned to hold a white power music festival near Portland. Former ARA members helped local residents pressure the host venue to pull out. Half a dozen of these activists, sensing a need for renewed vigilance, created Rose City Antifa, the first official anti-fascist organization in America. For Crenshaw, the evolution of ARA into Rose City Antifa, combined with Portland's centrality in the national protest movement that began in Minneapolis this May, shows that, quote, "the two cities are linked in a continuum of anti-fascist conscientiousness." In mid-September, I met with two current members of Rose City Antifa, Sophie and Morgan, in another Portland park. Asking for an anonymity, they use pseudonyms. Sophie, who is transgender, explained that some of the ARA groups were pretty strongly in a world of toxic masculinity. But Rose City Antifa had always had a, quote, "strong feminist and queer component," end quote. A number of its founders were women. Morgan, who identifies as a butch lesbian, said that Rose City Antifa adopted a more nuanced approach. Quote, "ARA was street-level confrontation with white supremacist gangs. We wanted to broaden the scope to encompass more activities that we saw as fascist threats," end quote. Such threats proliferated during the next 8 years. The election of President Barack Obama galvanized the so-called Patriot Movement, composed of hundreds of far-right groups and armed militias hostile to Muslims, immigrants, and the LGBTQ community. Though the Patriot Movement was seldom explicitly racist or anti-Semitic, it depicted the federal government as corrupted by un-American forces inimical to white Christians, a resurrection of the Posse Comitatus worldview. Despite this troubling ferment, anti-fascism remained a backwater of leftist activism throughout the Obama administration, as progressives focused on the rise of the Patriot Movement's political analog, the Tea Party. Then came Donald Trump, buoyed by a wave of white nationalism calling itself the alt-right. In 2017, many Americans were stunned when throngs of white supremacists carried torches and Nazi flags through Charlottesville, Virginia, chanting, "Blood and soil, and Jews will not replace us." Anti-fascists, however, were prepared. Hundreds of them traveled to Charlottesville in fidelity to the we go where they go credo. Clashes culminated in a neo-Nazi plowing his car through a crowd of counter-protesters, killing a woman. The former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke told a reporter, "We are determined to take our country back, and we're going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump." Later, Trump said that there had been very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, and Duke praised his honesty and his courage. At Peninsula Park, Mick Crenshaw told his audience that across-the-board collusion between the U.S. government and white supremacists was nothing new. In the past, however, quote, "they used to try to lie and cover the stuff up." Under Trump, the alliance was on display with unprecedented transparency. End quote. Now, Crenshaw said, the question is, how are we going to protect ourselves? In 2016, Rose City Antifa joined the Torch Antifa Network. There are now 10 Torch affiliates, which share a commitment to disrupting far-right organizing. According to Rose City Antifa, although affiliates occasionally exchange information and advice, there is practically little collaboration. The network focuses much of its energy on internet activism, doing research online, identifying proponents of bigotry, and then publicly exposing or doxing them. Rose City Antifa spent part of its early years doxing people involved with Volksfront, an international racist gang headquartered in Portland. Whereas ARA would have hunted Volksfront members in the streets, Rose City Antifa publicized their activities to employers, neighbors, and relatives. In 2012, Volksfront's U.S. chapters disbanded. Rose City Antifa doesn't disclose how many members it has, but Sophie estimated that doxing investigations take up about 100 hours per week. Reports on individuals, Sophie said, must meet rigorous standards. "We do what we can to make it an undeniable fact that the people we are doxing are tied explicitly to violent rhetoric or acts of violence. As muddied as the lines are right now, we don't want to go after someone for wearing a MAGA hat." Whenever people deemed worthy of doxing hold gatherings in public spaces, anti-fascists undertake to shut them down. Research and action go hand in hand, Morgan said. In Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, published in 2017, the scholar and activist Mark Bray writes that after the Second World War, Jewish veterans created the 43 Group, which stormed fascist assemblies with the aim of knocking over the speaker's platform. Though conservatives and liberals alike now criticize no platforming as a violation of free speech, anti-fascists take the 43 Group's view that incipient fascism tends to metastasize if left unchecked. Given that fascist movements ultimately aspire to mass oppression or even genocide, they must be stifled early. In the U.S., no-platforming campaigns have roiled college campuses. 3 years ago, when the right-wing polemicist and Breitbart editor Milo Yiannopoulos was invited to address Republican students at the University of California, Berkeley, anti-fascists besieged the venue, breaking windows and lighting fires. The speech was canceled. Shane Burley, a Portland native and the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, published in 2017, told me that many Americans recoil from such modern incarnations of no platforming because, quote, it has been extended to people who aren't consensus Nazis, people who not everybody agrees deserve to be hit, end quote. But Burley argues that anti-fascists are hardly to blame for this. Quote, it's the Trump effect. Nazi rallies have merged with the Republican base, and now they're in the same space together, end quote. Such merging is particularly common, Burley and other anti-fascists say, in the Pacific Northwest. During the lead-up to the 2016 election, Joey Gibson, a 36-year-old house flipper in Vancouver, Washington, founded the Christian pro-Trump movement Patriot Prayer, A former high school football coach, Gibson has an athletic build often accentuated by T-shirts that display his many tattoos, including one of a Spartan helmet and the words, Warriors for Freedom. In a recent phone interview, he told me that he started Patriot Prayer because he felt that his political values had become taboo. He wanted to venture into, quote, the hardest cities to voice your opinion in as a conservative, end quote. Places like Berkeley, San Francisco, and, just across the Columbia River from Vancouver, Portland. Gibson carefully avoids endorsing violence or espousing racism. His mother is Japanese, and Patriot Prayer has attracted some people of color. But it has also attracted white supremacists and members of known hate groups. According to Rose City Antifa, which has identified dozens of these individuals at Patriot Prayer events and published evidences of their allegiances online, from screenshots of racist Facebook screeds to photographs of swastika patches, Gibson offers neo-Nazis cover and provides them with a fertile recruiting ground. Another member of Rose City Antifa, who goes by the name of Ace, said the umbrella is broad enough to encompass a huge portion of the reactionary radical right, up to and including neo-Nazis. And that's why these rallies become such incredible spaces for radicalization. Around the time that Gibson launched Patriot Prayer, Gavin McInnes, a co-founder of Vice Media, created the Proud Boys in New York. McInnes has called the Proud Boys a gang of Western chauvinists. The FBI classifies it as an extremist group with ties to white nationalism. A former Proud Boy organized the neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville and called the woman who was killed there a fat, disgusting communist. The Proud Boys have been banned from Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, but their account on Parler, a social network catering to conservatives, has nearly 70,000 followers. Unlike Gibson, McInnes has openly celebrated violence against the left. In 2016, when a handful of Patriot Prayer supporters formed a Vancouver chapter of the Proud Boys, they became the muscle at Gibson's events. Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys began regularly descending on Portland, where altercations with Rose City Antifa counter-protesters were virtually guaranteed. Chaotic fights became recurrent events downtown. The purported reasons for Gibson's rallies varied, but Morgan, the Rose City Antifa member, said, "What they're really coming for is a fight. They're coming with weapons, hyped up and ready to throw down with whoever confronts them." Anti-fascist doctrine does not allow for avoiding such confrontations. "They will not pass" is another precept, deriving from the Spanish Civil War. But in the summer of 2018, several activists in Portland created a new organization, Pop Mob, short for Popular Mobilization, which aimed to enlist a more diverse and less militant league of protesters to counter Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys. Whereas Rose City and Antifa has strict vetting protocols for new members, Effie Baum, a co-founder of Pop Mob, told me, "Everybody's welcome under our tent, except cops and fascists." Pop Mob promotes what Baum calls everyday anti-fascism, not as an alternative, but as a complement to frontline combatants in Black Bloc. "If you're going to punch a Nazi," Baum said. "If you're going to stand back in the back with a sign that says, 'Love Trump's hate,' there's room for both of us." The feud reached a head this summer. On August 29th, when hundreds of Trump supporters met in the parking lot of a suburban shopping mall and then drove into Portland together. The route was announced just before the caravan's departure to stymie protesters. That afternoon, I interviewed Shane Burley at a bar on the east side of town after leaving the bar. I pulled onto a road full of honking cars and trucks bedecked with huge American flags and Trump 2020 banners. I followed the caravan out of the city, not realizing that dozens of drivers had broken off and headed downtown, where local residents shouted obscenities at them and threw water bottles. Some of the Trump supporters fired paintball guns and pepper spray from their vehicles. Others got out and assaulted protesters. It was dark when I arrived downtown, As I parked on a wide avenue in the shopping district, several people in black block sprinted by. Turning a corner, I came upon a small crowd facing a police cordon. Behind the officers, a dead body lay in a pool of light. The victim was Aaron Danielson, a 39-year-old supporter of Patriot Prayer. He'd been shot by Michael Reinhold, a 48-year-old white man who, although unaffiliated with Rose City, Antifa, or Pop Mob, once wrote on Instagram, "I am 100% Antifa all the way." Reinhold later claimed that he had fired in self-defense, and a canister of bear spray and a telescopic truncheon were found on Danielson. At the time, however, nobody in the crowd knew what had happened or who was involved. On August 25th, armed citizens traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where rioting had erupted after a white police officer shot a black man 7 times in the back. During altercations, Kyle Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old who'd come to Kenosha from Illinois, killed 2 people with an assault rifle. He then carried his rifle past police officers while someone yelled, "That dude just shot them!" Though Rittenhouse was later charged with homicide, Trump has defended his actions, and NBC News has reported that Department of Homeland Security officials were directed to make public comments sympathetic to Rittenhouse. For anti-fascist, the Reinhold case is an example of state-sanctioned murder, and the Rittenhouse case shows how extrajudicial killing can be outsourced to civilians. Morgan, the Rose City Antifa member, said, "That's what to me is uniquely terrifying about this moment. It feels like these far-right groups have basically been given the go-ahead to step in and commit this extra-legal violence where the police cannot but want to." Some leftists compare the president's demonization of dissent to the anti-communist fervor of the mid-20th century. Certainly, the right-wing culture of paranoia that he tirelessly fosters can look like mass delusion. In an August interview with Fox News, Trump spoke of an airplane, quote, "almost completely loaded with thugs, wearing these dark uniforms, black uniforms, with gear and this and that," end quote, which he linked to, quote, "people that are in the dark shadows, who control Joe Biden." The baseless claim echoed the Baroque anti-Semitic conspiracy theories of the cult group QAnon, which has gained surprising traction among Republicans, in part thanks to Trump's tacit approval of it. A week after the president's plane remarks, wildfires rampaged across Oregon, forcing more than 40,000 people to evacuate and killing 9. Smoke fled Portland skies and activists suspended demonstration, turning to relief efforts. While some protesters set up a donation point outside a shopping mall and others delivered supplies to rural shelters, QAnon promoted a false rumor that anti-fascists had started the fires. Trump has been openly laying the groundwork to contest the results of the election, and there is widespread concern that he will call upon his supporters to reject them too. "The only way we're going to lose this election is if the election is rigged," he has said. "We can't let that happen." During the first debate, Trump wouldn't commit to discouraging his supporters from engaging in violence while mail-in ballots are counted. When Chris Wallace, the moderator, pressed him to ask white supremacists specifically to stand down, Trump responded, "What do you want to call them? Give me a name." Biden brought up the Proud Boys, and Trump answered, "The Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left." The Proud Boys were ecstatic. One prominent leader wrote on Parler, "Trump basically said to go F them up. This makes me so happy." Within hours, standing by had become a new Proud Boys mantra, and T-shirts with the phrase were available online. On September 26th, the Proud Boys came to Portland for a rally against domestic terrorism planned after Aaron Danielson's death. Organizers expected thousands of attendees from across the country. Governor Kate Brown declared a state of emergency, and a U.S. Marshal federally deputized members of the Rapid Response Team, meaning that, in some circumstances, people accused of attacking them could face enhanced penalties. The rally turned out to be lackluster, with a couple of 100 Proud Boys drinking beer in a muddy field. After chants of F. Antifa, most of the men kneeled while a minister entreated God to, quote, reveal your purpose to the Proud Boys, use us to lift up this city, end quote. Following the prayer, the crowd emitted a communal grunt of Uhuru, the Swahili word for freedom, which Proud Boys have co-opted as a satirical battle cry. Speakers blared an electric guitar solo of the Star Spangled Banner, and a number of Proud Boys, instead of placing their hands over their hearts, held up the OK sign, a white power signal. Some people claim to use the gesture ironically to inflame liberal sensitivities. A few Proud Boys sported patches that said RWDS, Right Wing Death Squad, and one man wore a T-shirt that featured a portrait of Kyle Rittenhouse framed by the words, the Tree of Liberty must be replenished from time to time with the death and blood of commies. Though Trump's exaggeration of the threat posed by Antifa is likely a cynical ploy to scare up votes, Proud Boys seem sincerely and deeply worried about Antifa. I asked one if he thought that the protesters in Portland represented a significant danger. 100%, he said. They fundamentally want to change everything about America. It occurred to me that most of the anti-fascists I met in Portland would readily agree with that assessment. After this conversation, I went to Peninsula Park, where hundreds of the people, shame-feared, listened to Mick Crenshaw compare their light to his own. Compared their flight to his own, 3 decades earlier in Minneapolis. Later that night, many of the protesters headed to the Justice Center. The Proud Boys had left Portland without coming downtown, and there was a sense of triumph and relief. Black activists delivered speeches to a peaceful audience. I saw no vandalism. Yet, at some point, the rapid response team, freshly deputized as federal marshals, arrived with a large contingent of state troopers in riot gear. They stormed a park, assaulting and arresting people. Half a dozen officers dogpiled on a woman, wrenching her arms behind her back. A 73-year-old photographer was thrown to the ground. A journalist was shoved into a tree. Someone was maced at point-blank range. The show of force felt more intense than anything I'd seen in the past month. On this 121st day, it could have been a form of desperation or of vengeance. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening. That's it. So long, everybody.